Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On the NewsHour tonight, Memphis prepares for protests as video of the police killing of Tyre Nichols is released.
The FDA proposes easing restrictions on blood donations from gay and bisexual men, reversing what advocates have long called discriminatory policies.
And we visit a Baltimore school to see how teachers are helping students catch up on unfinished learning from the pandemic.
It's definitely been an uphill battle. A lot of them missed almost half of first grade, and those are the years that they learn and that they really solidify those foundational reading skills.
Welcome to the NewsHour. Authorities in Memphis and other cities are urging peaceful protest tonight as they release a graphic video of the fatal police beating of Tyre Nichols.
The 29-year-old died earlier this month, 3 days after he was hospitalized. Police brutally beat, tased, and pepper sprayed him for 3 minutes following a traffic stop. Five former police officers are now charged with his murder. Last night, friends, family, and supporters turned out for a candlelight vigil at Tyre Nichols' favorite skateboard park. The Memphis police chief has said there was no probable cause to warrant Nichols' arrest. And this week, many of the city's top officials have described the video of his arrest as horrific and difficult to watch. His mother, Rovan Williams Wells, has said that she couldn't watch the full video of what happened to her son. His last words, captured on tape, are said to be him calling out for his mother's help. Today, before that video was released, Wells told reporters about her son.
He loved photography. He loved skateboarding. He was just his own person, you know. He didn't follow what everybody else was doing. I tried to buy him a pair of Jordans one time, and Mama, I don't want those. He wants some Vans, you know. So, I'm just telling you guys, my son was a beautiful soul. He was a good boy. No one's perfect, but he was damn near.
We're going to take a closer look now at the police killing of Tyre Nichols and how the Memphis community is responding. I spoke a short time ago with the Reverend Earl Fisher, senior pastor of the Abyssinian Missionary Baptist Church in Memphis. Reverend Fisher, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
I imagine that there is a heaviness in Memphis, a deep sense of outrage, anger, shock, hurt. How are people processing what's transpired?
Well, that's a difficult question to respond to. I think all of the emotions that you articulated are definitely palpable. And at the same time, I think there's a sense of anxiety, but there's a sense of hope. There's a few steps that have been taken in the right direction towards at least a semblance of justice, because true justice would be Tyre Nichols would still be breathing. So, of course, our heart goes out to his family and we stand in solidarity with them. But it still remains to be seen, and I don't think anybody can actually predict what the next several hours or the next few days are going to hold.
What makes this case of police violence different is that all of the officers involved are Black. What also makes it different is how quickly they were arrested and charged. There are people who find a direct connection between those two things. But I want to hear your reaction to what Benjamin Crump, the attorney for Tyre Nichols' family, had to say about this today.
We want to proclaim that this is the blueprint going forward for any time, any officer, whether that be Black or white, will be held accountable. No longer can you tell us we have to wait 6 months to a year.
So what about that? That swift justice is the new standard, and that this Memphis case, this tragedy, proves that it can be done.
I definitely agree with the sentiment of Attorney Crump, and I think it's important to put into context so many different developments that led to what we have seen happen over the last few days. I don't think anybody should be caught up in a projected benevolence of people within the system just doing the right thing. This is the byproduct of several years of righteous and aggressive advocacy and activism work, from when Darius Stewart was killed in 2015, from bridge demonstrations in 2016, the removal of Confederate monuments in 2017, and the list goes on and on. What I deeply appreciate about what Attorney Crump said is that as unique as this case may be, especially insofar as this heinous and egregious video is concerned, what we definitely know is this is still part and parcel of a larger system and structure of policing. And we've been trying to advocate for righteous reforms here on the ground for quite some time, but they've been resisted and they've been reduced, which I think contributed to the moment that we're faced with now. So our heart goes out to the family of Tyre Nichols, and I even believe his mother and his father believe that this is not just about this isolated incident, because it's not isolated, it's interconnected to what's happening insofar as policing is concerned across the country.
Well, let me ask you about that, because Tyre Nichols was pulled over just blocks away from his home by this specialized police unit known as Scorpion, which was set up a little more than a year ago to police this surge in violent crime in parts of Memphis. And these specialized crime-fighting teams have been scrutinized for targeting people of color and for operating with impunity. What was the level of concern about this Scorpion team before this fatal assault?
Well, a few things I think come to mind. One is that the officers involved had all been on the force for 5 or less years. And you would wonder how they would be able to get in a specialized unit with such a short time span for experience. Not only that, I think when you think about the level of oversight and supervision that should have been provided to them, because I don't think anybody who's being mildly objective would perceive that this was somehow their first time engaged in this heinous behavior. You don't start off with this level of brutality on your first rodeo. You have to graduate to this point. So our question again is, who was responsible for the management and the oversight that should have been provided to them? They're connected to other units that people have been skeptical about, and we think that there's a covert nature to them. And to be fair to law enforcement, I understand because of some of their responsibilities, there might need to be some covert elements involved, but at the same time, there has to be enough transparency and accountability to ensure that these developments don't reach this particular level, because we don't have to be here today. We're here today in part because of the competing philosophies and ideologies about how to make the city safer. So Chief Davis, Mayor Strickland, they put this unit together in the fall of 2021. It didn't even take a year and a half before we have at least one dead body, and not telling if we have more bodies that have been brutalized, but just because of the grace of God, people didn't die.
Tyre Nichols was fatally beaten beyond recognition, his family says. The police chief says that this video of Nichols' arrest shows unconscionable behavior, acts that defy humanity. That was the phrase that she used. The FBI director said today that he was appalled by what he saw. How do you expect the city of Memphis will respond to this?
That's beyond my pay grade. I am hopeful and prayerful because of past patterns and practices from protesters. They have shown all manner of, we have shown all manner of poise and passion. And if there has ever been any escalation in past protests in Memphis, it was the police department that initiated it and escalated it. So I trust the poise and the passion of the people, and I've been trying to urge the citizens to look out for each other. So if somebody's out there and they see somebody doing something that's unbecoming, I would hope that they would intervene with the highest level of love and appreciation, not only for each other, but especially for the family of Tyre Nichols. I also think it's not the wisest thing to release a video that you know is going to be insightful and inflammatory on a Friday evening. I think there could have been some deeper discussion and dialogue about better ways to introduce that to the public. So again, we don't really know. I think those of us who have been on the ground for the last several years are going to be here for the long haul, and we are hoping for the best and still trying to prepare for the worst. Lastly, I would say, I think the air of the city has been impacted by the way mainstream media has couched the developments. I would have loved to see mainstream media outlets say stuff like Memphis plans for a peaceful protest as opposed to Memphis is on edge. When they started reporting that at the beginning of the week, I was looking around because I felt like I missed something. That hadn't been what was in the air. That hadn't been what I had felt. That hadn't been what my colleagues had felt. But now we have to brace for it and prepare for it. And so again, we're preparing for the worst and praying for the best.
Lastly, Reverend Fisher, we shouldn't lose sight of who Tyre Nichols was. He was all of 29 years old, was said to be a free spirit who enjoyed skateboarding and photography. He was a father, a man who deeply loved his mother. I know you were at the vigil last night. You had a chance to speak with his family members. What do they want the world to know about their son, their brother?
Based upon what they've been saying over the last several weeks, they want people to know how human Tyree was, how much he loved sunsets, they talked about, how much he loved skateboarding, how faithful he was in his work, his relationship with his mother, his father, his family, his child, I believe. So I think anytime we can humanize people who have been brutalized in this way is valuable. I also want to challenge us to continue to lift him up, to lift up others who have suffered similar injustices, and continue to journey with these families even after the cameras are gone, after the smoke clears, after the funerals, because people continue to bear the burden and the trauma of these instances. As his mother was saying, we should not have to do what we're doing now, so we'll do the best we can with what we have.
The Reverend Earl Fisher is senior pastor of Abyssinian Baptist Church in Memphis, Tennessee. Appreciate you, and thanks for giving us your time.
Thank you.
In the day's other headlines, new violence erupted in the Middle East when a Palestinian gunman killed 7 people in East Jerusalem before police killed him. It was one of the deadliest attacks on Israelis in years. Ambulance crews and police swarmed the scene near a synagogue. The attack came a day after Israeli troops killed 10 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. After those killings, militants in Gaza fired rockets overnight, and Israel's military answered with airstrikes. There were no reported casualties in that exchange. Russian artillery fire has claimed more lives in Ukraine's eastern and southern regions. Ukrainian officials say shelling today killed at least 10 people. Meanwhile, the head of the UN Refugee Agency accused Russia of kidnapping Ukrainian children. In Kyiv, Filippo Grandi said the Russians are taking children from occupied areas, giving them passports, and putting them up for adoption.
In a situation of war, you cannot determine if children have families or guardianship. And therefore, until that is clarified, you cannot give them another nationality or having them adopted by another family.
The Russians said they categorically reject the allegations. New Zealand's largest city, Auckland, faced torrential rains and heavy flooding today. The deluge triggered widespread damage, with water waist-deep in some areas. Submerged cars were abandoned as drivers struggled to get to safety. Officials warned some residents to be ready to evacuate. Back in this country, the Justice Department accused 3 men of plotting on orders from Iran to kill an Iranian-American journalist in New York. Mahsi Alinejad has spoken out against human rights abuses in Iran. She confirmed she was the target. In Washington, Attorney General Merrick Garland said Iran has pursued dissidents without regard for borders.
The Department of Justice will not tolerate attempts by an authoritarian regime to undermine those protections and the rule of law upon which our democracy is based. We will not tolerate attempts by a foreign power to threaten, silence, or harm Americans.
The 3 suspects are accused of money laundering and murder for hire. Former Vice President Mike Pence says he takes full responsibility for classified documents found at his Indiana home. In Florida today, he said, quote, "Those documents should not have been in my personal residence. Mistakes were made." The former vice president said he never knew the material was there, but that was no excuse. Republican leaders have reelected Ronna McDaniel to chair the Republican National Committee for 2 more years. They voted today at a meeting in Southern California. Former President Trump backed McDaniel, but some of his allies supported a challenger. President Biden made it official today. Jeff Zients will be his new White House chief of staff. Zients led the administration's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Before that, he ran the National Economic Council under President Obama. He now succeeds Ron Klain, who's stepping down after 2 years on the job. And on Wall Street, stocks managed modest gains. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 28 points to close at 33,978. The NASDAQ rose 109 points, and the S&P 500 added 10. For the week, the Dow gained nearly 2%, the NASDAQ climbed 4%, and the S&P rose 2.5%. Still to come on the NewsHour, as the world marks Holocaust Remembrance Day, why Americans know so little about its history. Ruth Marcus and Gary Abernathy weigh in on the week's political headlines. We take a look inside the acclaimed new theater production of Life of Pi, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The FDA today announced plans to ease a decades-old restriction preventing men who have sex with men from donating blood. A lifetime ban was put into place during the AIDS epidemic over fears of HIV transmission. The new guidelines would ask all potential donors about their recent sexual history instead of singling out queer men. Any potential donors who had anal sex in the last 3 months with new or multiple partners would not be allowed to donate. Anyone taking medications to prevent HIV infections would also be deferred for a period of time. For more on this, I'm joined by Cole Williams. He founded the organization Pride and Plasma last spring to bring attention to this issue. Cole, welcome, and thanks for joining us. We have to point out that for over a generation, gay and bisexual men have been shut out from donating blood as freely as anyone else and fighting for the right to do so. When you think about this moment, how important is it right now?
This is critical. This is the biggest reduction that we've seen since the policy was implemented in 1985. Every time that they cut it back, there was still a blanket deferment policy. This is the first time that we've really seen the FDA look at individual donors and see what their individual risk is.
Cole, you came to this work from a very personal experience. During the pandemic, the nation was experiencing a blood supply shortage. Your whole family wanted to donate, as I understand. What happened?
Yeah, so there was commercials. You couldn't miss them all the time on the TVs. And my family decided, as a four of us, that we wanted to go get blood. However, I knew that because of the deferment policy, I wasn't eligible. And that led to not a tense conversation, but definitely a little bit of an awkward one where I had to say, you know what? I can't. I wish that I could, but that's kind of the reality of this situation. And that's the impact of this policy.
You know, there are still a number of exclusions in place with the new policy, too. As we mentioned, anyone taking oral medication to prevent HIV or the injectable PrEP treatment is still subject to months-long deferrals. Do those make sense to you?
I'm going to say yes, I'm going to say no. I'm not entirely sure of the results of the ADVANCE study, which enrolled around 1,800 participants, and then they looked at the effectiveness and safety of an individual risk assessment. So when we are not having a blanket deferment policy anymore, I think that we still need to be looking at factors like how else are you having sex while using PrEP and Truvada and other means of preventing HIV? Because HIV isn't the only thing that we are looking for when we're testing blood donations. There's also hepatitis and countless other sexually transmitted diseases that can still be transmitted through blood donations. So until we see the results of the ADVANCE study and potential new research studies on this specific issue, I can't really say whether it is justified or not.
You know, Cole, we spoke to Sean Cahill, who is the director of health policy research at the Fenway Institute. He has been on the front lines of this fighting for equal rights for 14 years. He pointed out, look, the FDA was haunted by the experience in the 1980s when thousands of people were given blood that had HIV in it. And he says they're trying very hard to balance these two things, right? Allowing more people to donate, but also protecting the nation's blood supply. And he says they're doing a good job. Do you agree?
I do agree. The testing and understanding of HIV that we had in the 1980s is vastly different decades later. In 1999, we implemented nucleic acid testing on a national level. With that, the current risk of HIV transmission through a blood transfusion is 1 in 1.5 million. So we don't need to defer people based on their sexual orientation, not that we ever really needed to, but it was a lot more understandable back then. So I'm glad that the FDA is taking steps forward to discriminate a little bit less.
Now, there have been incremental steps over the years, but when you look back at when they've been taken, why they've been taken, why do you think it's taken the years that it has for these changes to be made?
I think that one of the biggest reasons is just decreased stigma within the LGBTQ community within our country, but also when we saw the reductions in 2015, 2020, from my understanding, there was not new research data. The ADVANCE study was groundbreaking, not only the number of participants that it had, but what it was talking about. We didn't have that beforehand. All of the previous reductions were just based on public opinion. So when we see that we don't have a blanket deferment policy or even a policy that looks at an individual's sexuality and sexual orientation, we just hadn't asked that question before and hadn't had evidence to back it up.
When we're looking at these kinds of restrictions and how they're put into place, who they restrict, is this just about blood donations to you?
Absolutely not. The FDA also handles tissue donation, which that includes your heart valves, your dura mater, your skin, tendons, bones, ligaments, a whole bunch of different tissues that people are waiting for in hospitals that patients are in desperate need of. There's a 5-year deferment policy for any man who has had sex with another man, regardless of the form, regardless if it was protected or safe, and whether that individual has been tested for STDs.
Cole Williams, the founder of the organization Pride and Plasma, joining us tonight. Cole, thank you for your time.
Thank you for letting me come on.
This is International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and it comes at a moment when there is growing worry about anti-Semitism in the U.S. and around the world. There's also been concern that too many people don't know enough about what happened during the Holocaust. John Yang looks at those concerns, starting with some of the ceremonies around the world.
At the site of one of the worst atrocities in human history, a call to never forget. Survivors and mourners gathered at Auschwitz for prayer and reflection. Today marked 78 years since Soviet troops liberated the Nazis' biggest death camp in the final months of World War II. This was the last stop for more than 1.1 million people, most of them Jewish. Among the attendees, Douglas Emhoff, who was Jewish, husband of Vice President Kamala Harris. He passed through the camp's notorious ironclad entrance bearing the ominous words, "Work makes you free," and paused at the death wall where thousands were executed. Just a few hundred miles away in Kyiv, a conflict on the minds of many. President Volodymyr Zelensky, who was Jewish, placed a candle at a memorial.
Today we emphasize even stronger than before. Never again to hatred, never again to indifference.
Dziś nazywają się Bucha, Irpień, Hostomel, Mariupol i Donetsk.
For the Auschwitz Museum director, Piotr Savinsky, the comparison was clear.
Similar sick megalomania, similar lust for power, and similar sounding myths about uniqueness, greatness, primacy, only written in Russian.
On a day to mark past mass suffering, growing concerns about what's happening now.
Despite the pledge to never forget, never again, there are signs that Americans' knowledge about the Holocaust may be wanting. A new survey for the American Jewish Committee found that only 26% of those questioned could correctly answer 4 questions about the magnitude of the Holocaust and its origins. Only 53% of those over 18 could correctly answer that about 6 million Jews were killed. And 34% said Hitler came to power by violently overthrowing the German government. In fact, he was democratically elected, an answer that only 39% were able to give. Holly Huffnagel is the American Jewish Committee's U.S. Director for Combating Antisemitism. She previously was a State Department policy advisor on the issue. Holly, what do you take away, or what do those numbers in your survey tell you?
So, John, I'll even take a step back and tell you why we ask those questions. So, American Jewish Committee, we have been doing studies on American Jews and the U.S. general public for the past few years on the state of antisemitism in America, how Jews are experiencing anti-Semitism, if the general public's even aware. And this year, for the first time, we put in questions about the Holocaust to the general public to see what they knew and if what they knew corresponded to how they answered questions about anti-Semitism.
And what did you find? Is there a link between knowledge of the Holocaust and anti-Semitic views?
There is. And while the report itself will be released in the coming weeks, I can share a few things with you now. So we found that Americans who answered 3 or more of the 4 questions, so 3 or 4 of the questions correctly, so they knew something about the Holocaust, they were more likely to know what anti-Semitism is, to know that it has increased in our country in the past 5 years, and to say that it's a problem in the United States, which is not something that those who answered less of those questions correctly were able to do.
What do you think accounts for this knowledge or lack of knowledge about the Holocaust that the survey found?
I think there's a few unfortunate issues, right, that we're working with right now. And Holocaust knowledge questions are being asked by many different communities around the world. In fact, the Claims Conference just came out with one on the Netherlands this week, showing just how many people in the Netherlands, young people, think the Holocaust is a myth. And so what we're up against is, one, the passage of time. So today marks the 78th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz in Nazi-occupied Poland. So time is working against us, and many of the survivors were probably only within the next decade will have actual eyewitnesses to that atrocity with us. The second thing is there are more genocides and more atrocities that have happened since the Holocaust. Unfortunately, never again. It has been again and again. And some people might not connect the reality of needing to learn those lessons from the Holocaust, needing to know that Hitler was democratically brought to power and how that can apply today. And so they don't make those connections. And I think the third and final piece is this younger generation, which we do know knows less about what happened, has grown up on social media, has grown up on the internet, where unfortunately that's where we see the most Holocaust denial, Holocaust distortion, and anti-Semitism today.
How should Holocaust education or the teaching of the Holocaust be improved?
So we're seeing some improvements, even right now as we speak. There was a bill that was it's going through Congress right now on encouraging states to mandate Holocaust education. Right now, only 20 U.S. states mandate Holocaust education, and several others have commissions. There's a total of about 39 U.S. states that are doing something related to ensuring that the Holocaust is taught in schools. But more can be done. More resources can be provided for teachers, including training on how to teach the Holocaust, age-appropriate materials. But then I think the venue that we're entering now is, how do we be innovative with teaching the Holocaust? How do we ensure that it's not just a history book, but it can be a survivor in three dimensions, which the USC Shoah Foundation is doing right now, speaking to survivors who might not be with us anymore, but their testimonies live on, or virtual reality, where you have Holocaust survivors taking people from their own homes in the United States to concentration camps and sites of the Holocaust and exposing them this way in more innovative, technologically advanced ways.
There, in the tape, we heard the director of the museum at Auschwitz compare the Holocaust with what's going on now in Ukraine. Is that a fair comparison?
We always are careful with Holocaust comparisons, but what I can say, John, is that what happened in Ukraine, the illegal invasion by Russia, there was Holocaust distortion happening from the very beginning, when Russian leaders said they were going into Ukraine to denazify it. That is completely inappropriate. It is an attack on Jewish memory and identity. It lessens what Hitler did. And so you can see some of those comparisons now. And that's why it's so important for the rest of the world to call that out and say, you don't say this, this can't happen, and speak out against it.
Holly Hufnagel of the American Jewish Committee, thank you very much.
Thank you, John.
And if you're looking for ways to learn more about the history of the Holocaust, this week our very own Judy Woodruff and Fred DeSam Lazaro were part of a discussion on how anti-Semitism spread leading up to the Holocaust and the relevance of those circumstances today. You can watch that online at pbs.org/newshour.
It's been more than a year since most American schoolchildren returned to classrooms full-time. Now school districts are working to recover learning that was lost while kids were at home during the pandemic. Researchers say students in low-income neighborhoods lost the most. I recently visited a school in Baltimore that's found innovative ways to help students catch up.
Are we being respectful?
Yes.
Are we ready to listen?
Yes.
A typical morning for fourth graders at Hollibird Academy in southeast Baltimore.
Quiet hands only.
After announcements, teacher Maya Alston leads students through a 15-minute mental health check-in.
If their minds are not ready to learn, the instruction is a lot harder for us, but also for them.
This daily ritual started before the pandemic, but it's taken on new importance after students return to the classroom. One way Baltimore City Public Schools is helping students catch up on unfinished learning from the pandemic.
Because they left off at a younger grade, it's like they're picking up where they left off, even with us trying our best to catch them up.
Not just academically, but socially and emotionally.
How have the morning check-ins affected your students?
I think they sometimes struggle even just with simple communication skills as far as like talking to each other during recess instead of being on their phones because they're so used to having that technology in front of them. Starting the day with a mindset of how are you or a check-in allows them to know that we care about them beyond their instruction.
Hollabird Academy is a neighborhood pre-kindergarten to eighth grade school where 100% of students are on free or reduced cost lunch.
We did experience that students had trouble or challenges in dealing with some of those social and emotional skills.
Principal Stephanie Pappas says prioritizing mental health is crucial.
We want to be intentional about building those capacities in students, including self-awareness and responsible decision-making and, you know, just ensuring that our students are able to demonstrate empathy for one another in an authentic way.
Hollabird has expanded its emphasis on mental health through community partnerships and additional training for teachers using an infusion of state and federal pandemic funding. Baltimore City Public Schools received more than $689 million from the federal government to address the impact of COVID-19.
We've invested quite a bit in our tutoring efforts, in our extended learning opportunities.
Joan Dabrowski is Chief Academic Officer for Baltimore City Public Schools. She coordinates programming for 75,000 students across more than 150 schools.
BCPS, like most public school districts, experienced extended virtual instruction. How has the pandemic affected students here?
We know that students had limited opportunities in virtual learning, and that we are now seeing, as we've come back to in-person, that we have work to do to bring those students back on track and to accelerate their learning so that we can ensure that they are ready to do well at their grade level and beyond.
Staffing is a key part of Hollabird's strategy. Additional funding enabled Hollabird to add 15 positions for teachers and aides. That allowed the school to put two teachers in most classrooms and offer classes like this on environmental sustainability.
You can see how that worm is digesting the organic material.
Today's lesson, how earthworms support ecosystems.
I see you guys!
The school district also partners with local groups that offer one-on-one tutoring during the school day for students identified as needing additional instruction. Hollabird itself has added small group time for all students.
A.M. Ham. A.M.
A.M. Ham. A.M.
Beautiful.
One of those small group interventions is called Just Words, which helps students with reading fundamentals.
It's definitely been an uphill battle. A lot of them missed almost half of first grade, and those are the years that they learn and that they really solidify those foundational reading skills.
Just Words instructor and fourth grade teacher Melissa Morella.
They don't really get any direct instruction anymore in reading in their general education classes. And so small group is a time where the kids who need that extra practice really can get the direct instruction with the teacher with me.
Morella also teaches English for speakers of other languages. About half the students at Hollabird are English language learners.
When these kids were at home during virtual learning, most of them didn't have any exposure to English at all. You know, their families all speak Spanish. You know, a lot of our English language learners, especially those who are newer to the country, really kind of had to relearn English if they'd already knew it, or kind of they had to take those extra steps once they got back to school to really solidify their English skills.
What's your favorite subject?
These fourth graders are among those benefiting from being back in the classroom.
What's the best thing about school?
I like to be in the school.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best because we can play with our friends and we can find more friends at school. It makes me happy to see my friends again and to like see people doing better.
Are there certain areas where you feel like you have to do more work to catch up? Maybe it's math, maybe it's reading.
I feel like I have to do more work instead of math to catch up.
Is it because of the pandemic and being at home for a year and a half, 2 years?
Yeah.
How has the small reading group helped you?
It helped me because like I was having a tough time like reading words, and when I go to Just Words,
It helped me sound out the words so I remembered them, and I learned new words that I didn't know how to read it.
Parents like Joanne Espinoza can see the difference a personalized learning plan makes for students like her son, Jason.
He was in kindergarten when the pandemic started, and that's when they started to learn how to write, make words, dibbles. He was struggling a lot, but now being in school, I can see the progress. I can see him thriving.
Helping students thrive is no small task for a school district that was already underperforming in 2020 and took a step back during the pandemic.
We know that even prior to the pandemic, our students had important learning needs. And yes, the pandemic intensified those things. Our energy is forward thinking. Our energy is around using our data to inform that instruction in service of getting our students back on track and getting our students on grade level.
The fourth graders in Ms. Alston's and Ms. Morella's classes say they notice and appreciate the help they're getting.
Coming to fourth grade, I was nervous because I didn't know it was going to be new people and new teachers. And now I'm happy to see my new teachers helping us.
And tomorrow we'll take a look at the national implications of learning loss connected to the pandemic and how schools across the country can best help their students. That's Saturday on PBS News Weekend.
After the police beating in Memphis and mass shootings in California, America is once again reckoning with its chronic struggle to prevent violence and hold the powerful accountable. Let's turn now to the analysis of Marcus and Abernathy. That is Washington Post columnist Ruth Marcus and her Post colleague Gary Abernathy. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart are away. Welcome to you both. Thanks for being here. I want to begin with this video we've led the show with, the pending release of the video showing the death of Tyree Nichols, or the police beating, rather, of Tyree Nichols. As we speak now, it has not been released. But before we begin to cover it in the days ahead, I'd like to get both of your takes on where we are right now. Having heard from officials how horrifying, how graphic the video is, and anticipating what happens next. Gary, why don't you begin?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's striking, isn't it, Amna, is that very quickly, I mean, it's only been 3 weeks, but very quickly, the police chief determined and said this was a failing of basic humanity, he said. They're preparing people for a really, horrible video, but apparently what happened by everyone who's seen it, it's a horrible thing. And it strikes to a culture that still exists, obviously. This is obviously they didn't wait to suspend these officers. You know, they fired them. They didn't say they're suspended based on, pending an investigation. They just fired them. So this is a horrific thing, apparently. You don't want to rush to too much judgment because, again, there's a lot we don't know. And it's a culture. It's not necessarily, in this case, a race-based issue, since all the officers involved were also Black. But there's obviously something that, most police officers wouldn't engage in this type of apparent brutality. But apparently that's something that happened that is still something departments everywhere need to address.
Ruth, how are you looking at this moment?
Well, it's a horrifying moment, but I'll start with a comparison that might make us in this terrible time embrace to see what is clearly going to be this terrible video feel a little bit better. Before Tyree Nichols in 1971, there was a young man named Elton Hayes. He was 17 years old. He was beaten to death by officers in Memphis. And in that situation, it was covered up. It took 2 years to charge the officers. All eight of them were acquitted. And as Gary was just suggesting, this is very different. Very interesting questions about the racial composition of those involved. But the Black female police chief had the officers quickly fired. These charges were filed with land speed record, and we are going, for better or worse, I'm kind of glad we're not seeing it in time for us to have to talk about it, because I really don't want to look. And they are being charged. So the response after the fact is very healthy. What happened before the fact is obviously really disturbing, and in some ways more disturbing on a certain level when it's black officers involved. It's horrifying when a white officer shoots and kills or is responsible for the death of a black man like George Floyd. But in those situations, police departments may have a theory of how they can improve themselves. They can make clear that racism is unacceptable. They can integrate their ranks and bring in people who theoretically will not treat members of the community that way. But when you have black officers involved in this kind of violence like this, you really do have to question whether there is something deeper and therefore harder to root out inside police culture. And that's the really scary part of this.
We'll, of course, be following this in the days ahead as well. But I do want to ask you both about incidents that we began the week with, which were back-to-back mass shootings in California. Just to give people a sense of where we are when it comes to gun violence in America, a few important stats I want to share. Every day in this country, 124 people die every day from gun violence. The leading cause of death for children 18 and under is now gun violence. According to the Gun Violence Archive, so far this year, there have been 42 mass shootings, more mass shootings than days of the year. And I was on the ground in Monterey Park, California, had a chance to speak with Congresswoman Judy Chu, who used to be the mayor there, calls that her hometown, and is now, of course, a congressperson. And I asked her, is this the moment that your fellow members of Congress act? What will it take? Here's what she said.
Those Congress members could be the next ones with a mass shooting in their district. Their constituents could be the victims, their neighbors, their family members, their loved ones. So until we stop this proliferation of gun violence, none of us will be safe.
Ruth, what do you make of that? Is she wrong?
Well, until we stop this proliferation of gun violence, which is a uniquely, disturbingly American phenomenon, whether it's mass shootings or individual shootings, we are suffering from an epidemic of gun violence. But I noticed she did not answer your question about whether this was going to be the moment that was going to catapult and galvanize Congress into action. It is not. I sat with mothers who had lost their children at the Sandy Hook shooting when they were hoping to at least kill a filibuster of efforts to pass an assault weapons ban, and they couldn't do it. This Congress is unable to get itself into action, and so we're going to need to see action on a state level, on a state-by-state basis. And the scary part to me is that the United States Supreme Court has made it harder for states, and we'll find out in coming years just how hard, to enact reasonable gun restrictions.
Gary, as you well know, and experts told us, states vary so widely, depending on where the rules vary so widely. So if California has some of the strictest gun laws in the country, but you can buy a certain weapon in Arizona and carry it right across. So does it take federal laws to fix our gun violence problem?
Well, that's an excellent point. California has maybe the strictest gun laws in the country, and yet this happens there. Here's a question. What's the answer? I'd like to hear a specific about what's the gun law we need to pass to prevent this. I don't think anyone really has that answer. The other side of this coin is—
I have some specifics, Gary.
Okay, Ruth, I can't wait to hear them. But what is it that makes people, good to see you, Ruth, too. What is it that makes people pick these guns up and go commit these crimes? What's the culture? What's the sickness of the soul that makes someone wake up one day and say, I'm going to pick up this gun and go massacre people? You know, let's acknowledge these guns don't get up and do this themselves. People pick these guns up and do this. What is it that we need to address to help prevent people from wanting to carry out these horrific acts?
Ruth, did you want to get in there?
Sure. I would suggest Gary and I are good friends, so we can disagree here. The sickness of the soul exists in other countries. Mental illness exists in other countries. It is America where we have more guns than people, when you have more guns than people, you're not going to be able to eradicate gun violence, but there's things that you can do. You can limit the size of magazines. You can raise the age of people who are eligible to purchase weapons from 18 to 21. You can have trigger locks in place or other fingerprint technology so that young children, like other people who shouldn't have guns, including the six-year-old who shot his teacher in Virginia recently, very near us, aren't able to get to guns. And you can enact red flag laws and respond in a very quick way to suggestions that there are people out there who may need to have guns taken away from them or shouldn't get guns. You can close the gun show loophole. I could keep going. Will this stop gun violence in America? No. Could it reduce gun violence in America? Yes.
Ruth,
look at California.
Ruth, I just want to, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I want to give Gary a quick chance to respond. We've got about 15, 20 seconds left. I'll give you the final word here, Gary.
Sorry, Gary.
Well, sorry, Ruth, but I think California has some of those restrictions, the magazine restrictions. Joe Biden just signed into law a bill back in June. They've called it the biggest gun bill in 30 years that has red flag laws, expands the red flag laws. So, again, I think there are always things to look at every issue, but let's don't do this. Let's don't point fingers at each other and say, you care more than I do, or I care, you care less than I do. Let's work together on this.
Appreciate both of your time. We could spend a lot more time talking about this one topic. Gary Abernathy and Ruth Marcus, thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Amna. Thank you, Ruth.
The play Life of Pi opened this winter at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge, Massachusetts. You may know the story from the best-selling book or the Oscar-winning film. But the creative team behind the play wants you to reconsider what you thought you knew. Special correspondent Jared Bowen of GBH Boston takes a look as the play heads to Broadway this spring. It's part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Life of Pi, the new Broadway-bound play at the American Repertory Theater, is a tale rippling with tests of survival, will, and belief. For the audience, too, because we are pressed to believe we're watching Pi, a 17-year-old boy, adrift in the ocean with a Bengal tiger. The play is an adaptation of Canadian author Yann Martel's Booker Prize-winning novel, which also became the inspiration for the 2012 Ang Lee film.
Without Richard Parker, I would have died by now. My fear of him keeps me alert. Tending to his needs gives my life purpose.
It centers on Pi, who, along with an orangutan, hyena, zebra, and tiger, is cast into the sea after a ship carrying his family and their menagerie of zoo animals sinks. It's Pi telling his story.
I'm going to die first unless I can get on that boat.
Or rather, stories. That he either survived with the animals in tow, or the animals were merely metaphorical stand-ins for his family and shipmates.
We are going to be fine.
I asked Yann Martel, the first thing I asked him when I met him, was, you need to tell me what really happened because I need to know the truth.
But when playwright Lolita Chakrabarty met with the author as she launched into the project, his only advice, don't lose the animals.
So he left me with that dilemma because it made me fulfill what he set up in the book, which is the ambiguity. So it is the animals who are on the boat, and yet there's an alternate story. And he sets up that we follow what we know, so we like to rely on what we know and what we can prove. So it's up to you when you come and watch the play, which one you believe.
Chakrabarty says she believes that ambiguity also goes to the heart of who Pi is, that his storytelling can be construed as a mechanism for exceptional resilience.
I think maybe we never know who we are until we're tested, and out of great suffering can come wonder. And I think Pi, in the extraordinary difficulty that he engages through the story, I can only explain it as enlightenment.
God help us, please!
In some ways a space to grieve, but also a really optimistic space to reflect on what we can bring forwards. So I actually think post-pandemic, I feel that the story has become even more relevant.
Max Webster directed Life of Pi to a slew of awards, including Best New Play in London's West End.
Should we gather around and do a bunch of minutes and give them?
Yeah!
We met as he rehearsed a new ensemble for the production's U.S. debut. Much of Webster's cast are puppeteers, animating the animals alongside Pi. It's a concept that plays directly into the work's themes of imagination.
We really know that the pieces of wood over there are not a zebra, but it's kind of like a game. You invite the audience up to play with you, just as a child plays, in a way.
Here, though, it's a much darker play.
It's not a sort of fantasy story in which the animals are cute. So this is nature red in tooth and claw, rather than a sort of anthropomorphized animal, set of animals in which you kind of want to hug them.
The team, led by puppetry and movement director Finn Caldwell, has spent considerable time studying animal anatomy, mannerisms, and behavior to make the puppets as real and as brutal as possible. Like in this scene, where the wounded zebra is attacked by a hyena.
We strip it right back to the beginnings and say, okay, this is what we think a zebra would do if it's very distressed. This is what we think a zebra would do if its leg was broken and it's trying to stand up. Bit by bit, build the detail up so that in the end we have a convincing picture.
A former actor and one of the puppetry minds behind the Tony-winning play War Horse, Caldwell says the magic comes in the symbiosis between performer and puppet.
The tiger is angry. I want the tiger to be experiencing the anger, but the puppeteer to experience that anger as well. They're not experiencing the anger for the puppet, but they are experiencing what is happening in the puppet. The tiger roars, and I roar as well.
And it must all happen together. Many of the animals are portrayed by multiple puppeteers. And in London, England's Theatre Awards, the Oliviers, cited all seven performers playing the tiger with the Best Supporting Actor Award. An historic first. The connective tissue among puppeteers, says Caldwell, is breath.
We start with breath to give you emotion. So I can be visibly upset just from the way that I'm breathing. And so again, we use that breath to let the audience understand the emotional state. The great thing about breath is that also it allows the puppeteers to communicate with each other without having to talk. So if something over there is very frightening and we're connected together, operating a puppet, by the way we breathe in response to that, we can tell what we might be doing next. And so I've taken on as a journey of being surprised to being calm without having planned it.
It's the breath of life of Pi that in this story of struggle and perseverance frequently leaves the audience struggling to catch its own. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jared Bowen in Boston, Massachusetts.
And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett.
And I'm Amna Nawaz. On behalf of the entire NewsHour team, thank you for joining us.